Welcome to TLLTS. That's right. It was me with GarageBand. Yeah. I had to play around with it this week.
Porkon's got you pegged, man.
You got me. You found me out. Woo. That's the way it is. Fun with GarageBand. Because if you have it, you might as well use it.
Why not? Right.
What the hell?
Why not? How about that? Yeah, okay. It's just a fun little app, but it has some obvious limitations. It's really difficult to compose your own music in it, but it's just fun to play around with it.
I got to get the music recording, man. I'm a musician. I used to be in a progressive hard rock band going back.
Got to speak louder because your waveform is really low.
Okay.
That perfect.
Right there is good?
That's great.
I used to be in a band back in like the early 90s with my buddies, and we used to do like progressive hard rock. And I got to get into composing, man. In Linux, definitely. So as soon as I get that going, man, maybe we can do some original music.
Yeah. What Pat said.
It's the Today Show with Ricky Lake. Lake. Oh.
Yes. No, it's the Tech Show with Dan and Link. That's what it is.
You forgot Pat.
I am Pat. He does talk, though. You know.
At least I talk.
And no, Alan, not that you wouldn't know.
I wasn't going to tell anybody.
He's sitting in the
corner.
No,
I wasn't going to tell anybody. Alan's not here tonight because his wife is sick, but or not feeling well or something. But I wasn't going to tell anybody. I want to see if anybody, like, it would have been trivia next time to see if anybody noticed how many people were actually.
It's the monumental 83rd episode. Show.
It is. Monumental Alan's because, why?
There will never be another
more episode than 83. One more than 82, that's why.
No more. See, now I wonder, should I still include him on the tag?
Ooh, the ultimate diss.
You don't include me on the episodes I missed.
What? Yeah, but you weren't here then. You weren't part of the group at that
no,
point.
No, there was one episode I couldn't make it. I was busy at work.
And I didn't include you on the tag?
No.
You know what? Link probably made me not at gunpoint.
Yeah, that's what it was. At gunpoint. No, you will not put his name on the tag. Damn it.
Pulled out a Smith & Wesson, put a point at your head.
No, you will not. You will not include him. But songs. Why? Do you want to play a... What do we call those things?
A thing?
Yeah, a thing.
Promo?
An ID?
Yeah, a promo.
An ID. Here's an ID.
Hi, this is Dave, your Canadian techie. You know what? When I'm compiling Gentoo in an igloo, I like to listen to the Linux League Tech Show.
That's nice.
That's what they That's do special. Over there in Canada.
They burp?
Yeah. It's from the beer, man.
And they all drink Molson, right?
Molson Triple X rocks.
Oh. No.
That's good
Listen,
stuff.
Listen, what we were going to... We had anticipated doing an interview tonight. We have a really great interview lineup tonight, by the way. Ian Murdoch from Debian is coming out to
gonna make
sure
you say that when we talk to
Debian,
him.
Not Debian. Like, you know, we all pick on it and call it Debian. It's really Debian. Ian Murdoch, the founder of Debian, is going to be on with us tonight. But we were also going to have some discussion with some of the authors of a book called The Firefox and Mozilla Garage from Prentice Hall Publishing. And
tonight?
Tonight. And they were unable to make it on the show tonight. Perhaps we will be able to speak with them at the very beginning of next month. I'm not entirely sure yet.
I thought you meant that they were coming on tonight. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah. They were going to come on tonight on the show. Yeah. And then what I just said?
Yeah, but you wait.
And Dan was picking on me earlier because, like, I wasn't paying attention to anything. Anyway, good publishers, good books. Please go check out Prentice Hall. They've been hooking me up lately with some books to review and stuff like that. Please check them out. And hopefully we're going to be able to hear from some Prentice Hall authors very, very soon. In fact, they did actually want to get us in touch with Marcel Gagne.
All right, Marcel.
We told him, no way, not again.
No way, not again. No, who we've already interviewed. Marcel is great.
We'll have him on again in the future.
Hopefully we'll have him on again soon. So that's like my public service announcement. Other than that, I've been way, way busy and have not even hardly had a chance to check my email lately. So, Dan, it's all you. All
right. I got a request for assistance. A curious thing. And I was talking to you about this before the show and on the load chat.
You have to lubricate it first.
Yes.
That's the answer.
Oh, is that why then it won't hurt as much?
Yeah, right.
Question. I was playing around with putting together a skeleton of a website, and I was working in just pure CSS using div tags and stuff, and I came upon a curious problem. I'm going to post the URL on the chat right now. But for those who aren't listening via the chat and those who aren't looking at the chat logs, the URL, I did tiny URL, so it's tinyurl.com/D2QV. So as again, it's D2QV. All right? DX2QV. That's going to take you right to the page in question. What happens is, for some reason, I have basically three sections. I got a header, the content, and a footer. Now, in the content section, is all inside a separate div. It has a menu that floats to the left, and then there's a block over there that's called content. The class is content, and that's where the main body would be. If what I'm noticing is when I first set this up, is there ends up being a margin for some reason between the header and the main content. That margin only occurs if there is a block level tag on the first line of the main content section.
Only the first line?
Only the first
line.
Only
the first line.
If I put, you know, any other content in there, just some text without being in a paragraph or a header, or if I put a line break command and then have block level elements underneath it, the margin does not appear. And I can't figure out why the margin is appearing. I've ran my, I validated the HTML, validated the CSS. Everything seems to look fine. I've had other people look at it. It just doesn't make sense. And the oddest thing about this, right? If you look at the page in Internet Explorer, the margin doesn't appear. It only appears to be in Firefox and Safari, which are the two browsers, browsers that I mainly use testing. But Internet Explorer does not show that margin. I don't understand.
Check regular Mozilla?
I know. I didn't look at regular
Mozilla. Galleon, Conqueror.
Opera.
Opera, there you go. Netscape, like, come on, Dan.
But I figured
you could at least give us a good test, man.
I'm just curious as to why it's Firefox.
Why it is that way.
I don't know. So check it out. If you have any ideas,
email
me, dan@thelinkslink.net, or post on the chat, or post on the forum, or, you know, any way you can get contact.
That's right.
Or tech show at the Linux Link.
Dan@thelinuxlink.net. And actually, if you have anything that you would like to email anybody in the world, just, you know, email it to dan@thelinuxlink.net. Yes. Because he loves
If you're looking
email.
For money.
dan@thelinuxlink.net.
Yeah.
If you need
assistance in transferring large sums of money from a Nigerian bank account.
Hello, this is Mike Ramuto.
I thought that was just me. It was supposed to be a secret.
Please wire me $10,000.
What is that called? It's 495?
419.
419. Did you check out that website that was in the fridge? Or no, it was on the blog section of that book. The 419.
No, I read through it, but I think I might have hit it before.
Oh, I had the book. Where did the book? Pat, give me the book. I'll put the website up there. It's really good. It's a funny site. There's a bunch of audio on there. It's really, really good. Phishing. 419eater.com. It's really funny that these are the guys who go and scam the scam artists. Definitely something worth taking a look at. Listen to. They actually get people
to do it
when they to get proof. They
get
have
people
to
send money to them. Yeah.
They get. If they also have them, you know, they say, "Look, I need, you know, a picture or something of you with verification." So they tell them to hold up a sign with some text on it.
Yeah.
And they get pictures and put them on the
web. What do they call that? Proof of life. When somebody gets kidnapped, they'll take a picture of them with a newspaper with the day before's date on it.
What?
When they kidnap somebody, it's called proof of life.
Yes. Yes, yeah. So, definitely 419eater.com. Before we talk to Ian Murdoch, do you want to check in with Happy Boy Bischoff?
Happy Boy. Happy.
He said, give him a call.
We haven't heard from him in a while.
Sure, why not?
So, why don't we let me see. Hopefully that's not
connected. See if he's on.
Sure, why not?
We could just do a Skype test with Matthew Bischoff and then hang up on him.
Skype test.
Good day, sir.
Crank call.
Hello.
What are you playing with over there?
I'm playing with the stuff.
Hello?
Hey, guys. How's it going?
What's up,
hey.
Matt?
How are you doing?
Very well.
I hear you're very busy.
Very busy indeed, yes. Tons of stuff. Yeah, I'm actually valedictorian in my class. So I've been working on my graduation speech and a whole bunch of stuff.
Congratulations.
He said
thanks.
Now, where are you going next year after you graduate?
St. Joe's Preps in Philadelphia.
Ah.
See, yep. He's going to be close.
Well, you're from New Jersey, aren't you?
He's going to be real close then.
You're from Jersey, right?
Yes.
Are we echoing real bad over there, Matt?
Oh, you are? Are you?
I guess you would know that, right?
No, you're fine, actually. I thought you meant I was echoing.
No, we wanted to know if we were echoing over there.
You guys are perfect.
So you will be in Philadelphia, which, of course, is only
70 miles away.
70 miles away from us. So you can expect to be drug out of your nice warm bed in the middle of night, one night by a bunch of sloppy, fat, beer-smelling techie
that's
guys.
Scary, man.
Or just Alan.
Yeah, or just Alan.
that run Linux, too. So.
That's right.
Yep.
I'm going to come over and make you reformat your hard drive.
Yep. Wait, how old are you, Matt?
I am 14.
I think Alan has to register before he goes down.
Oh, man.
Wow, that's great. So why did you choose the prep school?
It's just really best fit for me, I think. Looked at a lot of schools. And that is just the best one that I could come up with.
So you haven't been podcasting lately?
No, I have not. But I think I'm set to go again. Science fair is over, and I should be able to. And I think I've solved the technical issues that I was having, getting some buzz creeping into my recording.
Was it from a radiator?
No, that's the hiss. The buzz is from the fan.
What was your science project on?
I did it on implicit associations from the book Blink, The Power of Thinking Without Thinking. It's kind of a subconscious bias thing. It's kind of cool.
Oh.
It's just Google IAT. It's,
you ate who?
Interesting. What?
You ate who?
No, IAT.
I'm just pissing with you, Matt. It's okay, really.
Okay. So how's everything at the Linux Lake Tech Show headquarters?
Hot. Cleaner.
But it doesn't smell as much.
Yeah.
No, but it's hot.
We've had our own audio issues the last month or so.
Alan screwed everything up by getting
we bought a new mixer.
Mixer.
And, you know, just getting everything set the way we wanted to.
Yeah, I've listened to the show. I heard the Dave Schlesher episode, and that was interesting to listen to.
What do you mean by that?
It was just a good show.
Oh, okay. Because I mean, that was in the context of we're talking about our audio issues, and we thought that show went off pretty well.
You sounded good on that.
Yeah,
I thought it was good too. And he said it was interesting.
I thought you meant like the audio was bad. We're really sensitive about our audio.
Yeah, you are. You're paranoid.
Interesting was the Richard Stallman episode. If you get a chance, check that out.
Mm. Yeah.
So have you guys got a chance to take a look at podcastpro.com?
Podcastpro.com. I have not actually seen it. What?
I looked at it a while ago.
Explain that to us.
What is that?
It is the podcast project that I'm working on with a few people. Just I'm also talking to Andrew Grumman at the same time. He's working on the latest version of iPodder Lemon for Windows and.
I don't recall you ever trying to set up any interviews with the author of Bash Potter.
No, you know, I wasn't interviewing him. I'm testing the latest version. That's all.
Oh. See, you need to do that with podcasting clients other than Bash Potter. You need to test them frequently.
Right, because they're unreliable.
That's right. Exactly. See, now you heard it here, folks.
No, I have actually had some issues. iPodder X now is does not work well with Tiger. If you reboot, you actually have to update the license code because 3.0 hasn't come out yet. And I don't know. I may just have to, you know, compile Bash Potter for OS X and just
see now. You don't even have to compile it. It's just a shell script.
You don't even have to compile it.
It's just download it and run it, and it goes.
The one thing we need to incorporate into Bash Potter is BitTorrent.
Yeah,
that would be cool.
If you use the GUI, you can get to BitTorrent.
Really?
There's plugins.
And plus, there's a bunch of user-contributed stuff.
Or Leon's GUI.
Mine. Well, both of them, really.
I've been using Leon's.
But, yeah. What he said. Anyway.
All right, Matt. We thank you for touching base. We actually we have to get rolling because we got to make a phone call to Ian Murdoch. You know who that is, right?
Big dude.
No idea.
No.
Come on.
Get with the program.
Oh.
Who's Ian Murdoch?
He's the founder of Debian Linux.
Oh, okay. Well,
that's pretty
cool.
Big.
Yeah, he is.
Definitely.
Cool.
Definitely. Yeah.
We'll keep in touch.
I bet. We'll have to ask him, but I bet he's heard of you before. See, so you're kind of slighting him there, you know.
Well, I've heard of him. I just didn't know. I couldn't, you know, remember. I had to look it up on Wikipedia.
Look at him backpedaling now. All right, Matt, we'll talk to you later.
Take care.
Hey, thanks a lot, man.
Good luck.
All right, bye-bye.
Let's call Ian. Fire it up.
Hours of nervousness.
You know the extension, right?
Yeah, I know. Wait, let me double check.
Double check.
Go ahead and Link. Tell us something new.
Right, so you want to call up... Who do we want to call? We want to call up... I don't know.
Yes.
Call up Dan. Just call like 555-1212. Tell him you want to talk to him.
Yeah, I thought that's what it was.
Yes.
No problem.
Let's talk to Ian.
Wait, am I in the right? Oh, come on.
Dan's busting stuff over here.
Yeah.
See, like, our whole show is centered around this interview thing, and Dan can't even dial.
I need to be on the, you know, it's this whole...
He's flicking screens
BNC
on
into
his...
the Skype box. Boondangle. Boondangle. Ooh, all right.
Fired up.
Something.
Ready? Everybody's ready?
Okay, clicky.
Oh, come on.
He broke it.
There we go.
There we go.
Oh, here we go.
We got to put the cursor in there first.
If you listen real close, you should be able to hear the menu of Ian's business.
Thank you for calling Progeny. Our offices are now closed. You may enter your party's extension at any time during this message. For a directory listing by first name, press 2.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I gotta put it in.
See if this works.
Please wait while I try that extension.
It's working.
Dim wonders of Skype.
The extension you have dialed is either invalid or not available.
Thank
you. Try it again.
Try it again. Maybe it didn't register correctly.
May enter your party's extension at any time during this message. For a directory listing by first name, press 2. For a directory listing by last name, press 3. To leave a general message in our company box.
Oh, wait, I didn't want to press that.
Repeat this message. Press 7.
I don't think this is awesome, man. This is like how to play with the phone zone through Skype.
What I would do, Dan,
what
is pop in the extension and redial it. Hang up.
You think so?
Yeah, put the extension right at the end of it and just call it. See if it pipes through. Sometimes that works.
Put a couple commas.
You think?
Yeah,
well, it didn't like that.
Commas, a 1 second pause. Used to be back in the olden days. Yes, I'm one of those old BBSer kind
of. Says invalid phone number.
Get rid of the comma.
We'll see what happens. Somebody talk while I figure
this
out.
This could be a problem. What we're trying to do is call Ian on his work number. Oh, it's dialing.
Okay.
Try
the thing here.
Please wait while I try that extension.
Wonder why it wouldn't be registering that extension. Doesn't make any sense.
We're back.
Ian, how are you? This is
Ian.
This is Pat from the Linux and Tech Show with Dan and Link.
Oh, hey guys.
How are you tonight?
How you doing?
I'm good. How are you doing?
Excellent.
Great.
Sorry about that little delay there. We had some issues trying to get the extension in.
We're calling via Skype, and it's a little funky.
Yeah, it's pretty tough.
But you sound okay, which is good.
Okay, well, that's good.
This is really a huge honor to talk to you. For people who don't know, Ian is the founder of the Debian Project, you know, one of the cornerstones of Linux distributions in the Linux world. And he's currently, CEO of Progeny now?
Basically, I couldn't hear what you said there first, but... Yeah, I'm chairman of Progeny.
So I guess we could start with a little bit of the history of how you started the distribution.
Now, you know what? I want to start with something else first.
Okay, go ahead.
Ian, you can hear me, right?
Yeah.
I got a question for you.
I'm sorry, what?
I have a question for you. And maybe you could help me out. Because like you, I'm trying to find a decent RSS aggregator that suits my needs.
Yeah.
Have you been successful yet?
I told you if I had some time this week, I'd get Skype set up so that you could just call me on that, and I didn't have a chance to do that. So I don't know if that answers your question.
know what? You probably...
Not yet.
Wait. I was reading your blog, okay?
Yeah.
You said you were looking for a decent RSS aggregator?
Yeah.
Did you find one yet?
No. I'm still looking.
Okay, because I'm in the same boat as you with the RSS aggregator. I'm trying to find one that I think fits my needs perfectly.
See, now I'm gonna have to write one now. It's gonna be another one of them, you know, 20-minute.
Yeah, I don't know. I have this problem where I pretty much hate everything I use, and so I end up thinking about. You know, if only I had the time, I'd do this. So, I've got this huge stack of projects that I'll never get around to doing. So, I tell you what, if you guys can write one for me, I'll tell you exactly what I wanted to do.
What do you need it to do?
well...
So the whole world is listening right now, so, you know.
The The whole world
is listening. Right, that's right.
Okay. Okay. Here's what I wanted to do. I wanted to live in Firefox, because that's what I use, right? I think that RSS is just an extension of the web, so an RSS reader should just be an extension of a web browser. Makes perfect sense to me. I want to be able to read my stuff offline, but I want to be able to synchronize it with one of these web-based blog things, so that if I'm on my on my phone or something, I can catch up on my blogs. I want to be able to post to it from there. I mean, why do you have a separate blog reader and blog writer? You caught me unprepared. I got a whole list of things. I'll put it in my blog, and then you guys can start a project, and you can write the blog RSS aggregator to end all RSS aggregators, and I'll be happy.
Great. Yeah, we could do it as a project together. We could name it like Linkian, right?
There you go.
Yeah. I figured our lead developer Alan would do it.
I've learned that it's a very good marketing strategy to put your name in everything you do. Right, that's kind of the Donald Trump philosophy.
Sure,
they will remember
you. As a hacker, you got to be a little more clever about it. So, I did it in a way that it took people years to figure out what it meant. And along the way, I heard some pretty interesting theories. The cat finally got out of the bag eventually, and all my fun. Ended.
All right, now Pat, you can roll in the Debian and progeny.
I guess what people want to know, Ian, is take us back to the time when you were starting the distribution. What was it like at the time? Why you started Debian?
So, like virtually everybody in those days, this was late '92, early '93. I was in college. I was a college student at a university in a northern climate, namely Purdue University in Indiana. And it was winter and it was cold, and I wanted to find a way to do my lab work without having to walk across campus. So I started looking around for a Unix that I could run on my PC at home. And, I found a couple of things. I found SCO Unix, but it cost $3,000 or something, and I didn't have any money. But I eventually found 386 BSD and Linux. And, so I played with both of them for a while. And, I was initially a little more impressed technically with 386 BSD, because it had the nice history from the Berkeley days. But Linux, Linux was, I think, technically less elegant and certainly more chaotic. But what was really gripping about it was all these people that were working on it, the community that had formed around it, and pretty much sucked me in immediately. And in terms of how Debian grew out of that, anytime you get involved in a community like that, any group of people, particularly when that group of people is giving you something which you consider very valuable, one of your first natural reactions is, how can I contribute back into the pool? What can I do to give something back to this? And at the time, there were a couple of Linux distributions. The main one was called SLS, which stood for Soft Landing Linux System, and it had all kinds of problems. The main source of the problem was the fact that it was done by this one guy, who was clearly very smart, but just completely overwhelmed by the amount of work that was required to do the job right. And so I thought, I what I'll do is a better distribution, I'm an egomaniac, so I named it after myself, But I also recognize my own limitations, which, namely, that I didn't know everything, and that I was in college, I didn't have enough time to do it all myself, and you know, I looked at 386 BSD, and that was largely a one-man project. I looked at SLS. That was largely a one-man project. And so, you know, it's kind of a natural solution to the problem was the... hello?
Yeah, we're still here.
Okay, I heard a click. The natural solution to the problem was, you know, to do it like Linux in an open, distributed fashion, and where I would serve more as, you know, kind of a conductor or master of ceremonies. Sole author of the thing.
Do you still have involvement with the project today, or no?
Do I still have involvement?
Yes.
Yeah, I do, and I do to some degree. You know, I'm just one of many voices these days, and it's been that way for 10 years, longer than 10 years. My primary involvement today is the Progeny. So, you know, we do a lot of work with Debian. We have you know, half a dozen Debian developers working here and contributing in various ways to the project. I mean, you know, we kind of see ourselves as being a layer around Debian, and you know, we're part of the big community, and we take from it and we give back to it, and you know, everything works wonderfully.
So, what exactly is Progeny? I mean, other than your place of work, but explain that to our listeners and how that interacts with Debian.
Sorry, I lost about half the question there.
What exactly is Progeny, and how does that interact with Debian?
So, by the way, are you guys hearing me all right?
You're coming through perfect.
Sounds fine.
Okay, good. So, basically what we do is we build custom Linux distributions primarily for other companies. So, you know, it turns out that there's a whole, you know, a whole slew of product categories that are increasingly basing their products on Linux. Probably the best known example is TiVo. You know, TiVo is basically pretty much run-of-the-mill general-purpose PC running Linux. And the thing is, these companies that are building these kinds of products, for the most part, you know, they decide they want to base on Linux for any number of reasons. And the next step isn't clear, right? So what does it mean to base a product on Linux? Well, you know, you can't go out and take Red Hat off the shelf or SUSE off the shelf and just use it, because by definition you're building a product that doesn't look like Linux, right? So you want to customize it, you want to change it, you want to integrate your own stuff with it. Basically what we do is we provide technology that makes it easy for companies to do this. We primarily, up to this point, been largely a services provider. So, for example, HP is one of our customers, and they've recently built a product for the telecommunications industry based on Linux, and they came to us and said, we want this, we want to build a Debian distribution for this thing, and here's what we want it to look like, and you know, we built it for them, and we're maintaining it for them. What we're doing now is we're actually moving more into the product space. So we've got some really neat new projects coming down the pike. Basically, productizes a lot of this stuff, and you know, hopefully in the next few months we'll have a preview of the thing out. Basically, it's a distribution building toolkit. You know, if you want to build your own distro, you download this toolkit, which is called Componentized Linux, and you say, this is what I want in my distro. You know, I want these components, that's what we call them, the features and technologies that you can pick from. You know, I want it to have this logo when I boot up. I want my default NTP server to point to this machine. You know, all this stuff is done in a central descriptor file, and we're modeling the customization process around the standard edit, compile, debug metaphor, right? So you want to change your custom distro, you edit the descriptor, you you compile the descriptor, which compiles it into an ISO image with an installer or an app repository. You can then install it and test it and do whatever else you want to do with it, and you know, figure out what change do I want to make next. You loop back around, edit the descriptor again, recompile, and so forth. So this is really neat stuff. It's pretty early in development, but it's, you know, I've been starting to play around with it lately, and you know, I'll make a bold prediction that this is going to change the Linux distribution industry as we know it.
That's awesome.
I don't do anything unless you know, unless I can say that.
That's awesome. So and of course you have a review copy that you'd be willing to send us, something, you know, can make a tech show distribution sort of thing, right?
Well, I tell you what, we have a componentized Linux community site. It's at componentizedlinux.org, just one word. And we have some kind of previous versions of this technology available here now. This was largely a sort of Skunk Works project here at Progeny up until about a month ago. Actually, up until earlier this year, we started talking about it a month ago. But, you know, we've got, honest to goodness, development teams working on this now. And it's going to be later in this year or early next year before this thing's actually commercially available. In the meantime, we continue to do the services-oriented engagements for people wanting this kind of thing. So, you know, if you've got six figures, we can build the Linux Link tech show distribution for you. but in the meantime, you know, just keep an eye on the componentized Linux site, and there will be a preview release at some point, probably mid to late summer. You know, we're still working out a lot of the file formats and whatnot, and we want to make sure we've got those right before we you know, flip the thing out there. But you know, it's really cool stuff.
Now, this componentized Linux, and also, I guess, would be Progeny. Is that all going to be like off a core of Debian, or will it be also like other distributions, like maybe a Red Hat based or Slackware or any other distribution, or is it just strictly like Debian core?
Well, so you know, our primary focus, of course, is on the Debian core. We kind of build componentized Linux as a meta distribution, so. You know, you can think about it as it's a set of components, which basically can be roughly thought of as the features and technologies that you would expect to find in a distro. You know, pretty high level, coarse grained sort of things too. So we're not talking about libacl1 kinds of things. We're talking about Active Directory support. J2SE 5.0 runtime. I mean, so instead of thinking about maybe thousands of packages, imagine, you know, dozens or hundreds of these coarser grain components. And essentially what that does is that gives us a layer of abstraction above the distribution, and we can then map that abstraction layer into multiple package sets. So yeah, our main interest, for obvious reasons, is the Debian package set. But we also are working on an RPM package set as well. And that package set is going to be based on the Linux Core Consortium platform. I don't know if you guys are familiar with that, but it's basically it's a reference implementation of the Linux standard base that we're putting together with Mandrake Soft and I guess Mandriva now is Mandrake Soft and Connectiva and Turbo Linux. So we're basically trying to put together a more or less industry standard, vendor neutral RPM core that's a faithful implementation of the Linux standard base. And put it out there as an alternative to the dare I say, increasingly proprietary RPM platforms from the other guys, and all base our products on that, and go from there.
It seems like every new distro nowadays is originally based on Debian.
Yeah, you know, I've always wanted to do a, you know, those old Unix family trees?
Right.
You know, where it starts with System 7 and whatnot, and branches off, and first system, well, I don't know, I don't remember. But I've always thought it'd be interesting to do a similar thing for Linux distributions. Because, yeah, I think that just about everything you can think of, except maybe Slackware, is based on either Red Hat or Debian.
Pretty much.
And the ones that are based on Red Hat largely ceased being related to Red Hat a long time ago. So the really unique thing about Debian is there's still this common tie, right, that binds us all together, which means, you know, you can go to the web and you can download a Debian package and you can be reasonably assured that it's going to work, whether you're running Debian or Linspire or, you know, something else. Of course, you know, there are a couple things happening these days which are threatening that. But for the most part, that's what makes the Debian world so unique is that, you know, Debian packages just work. It's largely because we've all done such a good job of staying compatible with each other.
So you don't end up in RPM hell.
What's that?
You don't end up in RPM hell. Like you do with distributions.
Know, trust me, doing this work with Mandriva and company, I mean, it's a mess. It really is a mess. And you know, the Debian community has to keep this in mind. You know, it's really tempting to, and you know, I say this as someone who in some of our initial work 5 years ago when we had a progeny Debian, we were guilty of this to a certain extent. You know, it's really tempting to run off ahead and do your own thing, but the problem is you start losing a lot of the ties to the rest of the world. You know, the compatibility that brings, and you know, that's where the RPM hell starts.
I think the question that a lot of people want to know is you've talked about it recently on your blog, is Ubuntu and your concerns about, you know, using different packages, customized packages. The code base forking, and you know, your main concern is keeping everything compatible.
Yeah. You know, I'm a big fan of what Mark Shuttleworth is doing. I mean, he's obviously doing something right. I mean, just let me put it this way: when I first heard about what he was doing, I thought he was nuts. Because you know, I didn't think that you could possibly build a new distribution in 2004 and convince anybody to use it. But you know my hat's off to him. He's managed to do it and do it spectacularly well. I think the problem is, you know, isn't the fact that he's got his own ideas about what Ubuntu should look like. It's that he's doing what I just said is tempting to do just because it's easier. Is just to run off ahead and not really think too much about how your thing fits in with the rest of the world. And, you know, I mean, this whole internet thing and open source thing and Linux thing, I mean, if we didn't have standards and if we didn't have compatibility and if none of these things, you know, if you had to speak a certain protocol to talk to a certain machine, or have, you know, your binary in a certain format to run it on a particular distribution, we wouldn't even be talking. So, you know, granted, it's a big leap from where we are today to that point, but just all you got to do is look at the RPM world to see what's going to happen if we keep going down this road, because at some point, Connectiva and Mandrake, Linux and Turbo Linux and all these guys were quite compatible with Red Hat. They just all went their own directions, and you know, we ended up with 18 billion different Linux distributions that are almost compatible with each other, but not enough so that, you know, if you're an ISV like Oracle and you want to sell your stuff, you've got to support one vendor's very specific version. And let me tell you, that doesn't promote competition.
We run the risk of becoming like Unix, going back, you know, a few years ago, where everything just forked off into its own direction. And
yeah, you know, I mean, fortunately, it's not that bad because it's open source, it's free software. So, you know, a lot of times when I talk about fragmentation and these kinds of things, people say, but, you know, it's GPL, so it's never going to happen. And to a very real degree, they're right. I mean, there will always be a Debian, no matter what happens with Red Hat or IBM or any of these other commercial players. The problem is that, you know, the number of people out there in the world that are going to get their, just like in 1993, I mean, if you go back and you read the Debian Manifesto, you know, I talk about the importance of distributions, and this is how, and at that time, and people said, why do you need a distribution? Because, you know, only idiots don't know how to compile their own system. I mean, it's, the argument is that there's an order of magnitude more people that would be using Linux or developing on Linux or whatever if you packaged it up nicely. And you can take that same argument and apply it to the situation today. There's enormous numbers of people that aren't going to go download their distribution. They're probably not even going to go to Red Hat and buy it. They're going to go to IBM or HP or Sun and buy it. My contention is that, yeah, I mean, Linux will continue to exist no matter what happens in the commercial space. But, man, I mean, 10 years ago, I just would have been stunned to look at everything that's happened in the decade since then. It's just we used to talk about how we were going to change the world and kind of laugh about it, but you know, wow, we've actually done it, and this is the next step.
Ian, yeah. Could I have you back up a second? And some sure. Questions are coming in from the chat. We're going to specifically focus on Ubuntu because it's the easiest one, I think, to point out what the problem actually is. When you say there's a concern about package format between Debian and Ubuntu, what do you actually mean? I mean, what is the problem? Is it the way that the packages are built? Is it the libraries they depend on? What is the problem that you're identifying that could cause this fragmentation?
Well, you know, it's largely development environment. So I think that, you know, the problem isn't so much that it's diverging, it's that developers are actually starting to use it to build packages. You know, so I'm sure there's been divergence, Linspire and Zandros and all these other guys. I'm sure there's been divergence before. But people were still building packages on Debian. So they would build the package on Debian. It would link against the Debian libraries. It would have dependencies to the current Debian versions of stuff. And these days, I've actually found myself in two or three situations where I've gone to download a so-called Debian package, and I've downloaded it, and it doesn't work because it's missing dependencies or, you know, there's a newer version of some library than is available in Debian. And, you know, it turns out that what happened is the thing was built against Ubuntu. And Ubuntu, because Ubuntu is tracking unstable, there's just newer stuff there. So, you know, I think if the packages were clearly labeled as Ubuntu, it'd be a better situation than it is today.
Don't they have separate app repositories?
They do, but see, a lot. One thing that I can think of in particular was the Red Hat has a new project called Network Manager, which basically what it does is it does automatic management of 802.11 connections. And so I went over to their page, and they had all these download links, and sure enough, they got Debian packages, right? So I downloaded the Debian packages, and they don't work. This wasn't from the Ubuntu repository. This was from some person who built a Debian package, built it on Ubuntu, and it just plain didn't work. So it was an Ubuntu package. This doesn't build a whole lot of confidence, particularly given what I've said about, you know, one of the main technical advantages of Debian is that you don't have to have an RPM for Red Hat 7.1 and Red Hat 7.2 and Red Hat 7.3 and Mandrake whatever and SUSE whatever. I mean, there's just one Debian package and it just works. So, you know, it's not a huge problem yet, but if we keep going down this road, I guarantee you we're going to be talking about Debian hell in you know, 2 or 3 years.
Speaking of that, speaking of Debian hell, one thing that I run Debian myself on a Spark machine at home, but one thing that I've noticed about Debian is it's picky about what software you're allowed to install on your machine. Don't you feel that creates a problem?
What do you mean by picky?
Picky, like I had to jump through loops to get Pine installed.
Oh, because of the licensing
reasons? Because of the licensing issues that nobody else seems to care about but Debian.
Yeah, you know, I'm of a similar mind about that. I mean, I suppose it makes a certain amount of sense to provide a completely free distribution, but it should be easier to layer the, you know, so-called non-free bits on top of that.
Now, I'm with you there, too, and on that thought, we also just had Richard Stallman on our show not too long ago, and he is now, instead of promoting Debian as a free Linux, quote-unquote, I don't have the name. Do you guys remember the
Utuntu,
name?
Utuntu, some distribution from Argentina that supposedly
he's promoting another Linux distribution instead of Debian, or at least that's what he said on our show. So,
but it doesn't have it installed on his machine.
Is that what he said?
But that's what he pushing.
Yeah, that's the old installer are one of the very few problems I have ever had with Debian.
I guess what one of the biggest criticisms of Debian is the slow release cycle. I know Debian strives to be stable. That's the whole core of it. But I guess Ubuntu and some of these other distros, they're filling a void, you know, in between
Debian, they're doing Debian on a brand new kernel with all the bells and whistles and the new software and the new functionality and stuff like that. What is your opinion on that? Your thoughts?
You know, there's no question that you know, to the extent that Ubuntu is a fork, there's no question that Debian, to a very large degree, brought this fork on itself. And you know, like a lot of other situations in the the past where this has happened, I hope that this situation causes the Debian group to, you know, take a look at what's not working and fix it. And, it's more specifically, I'm hoping that after Sarge gets out the door, which it finally looks like it's just about to get out the door.
I heard release date at the end of the month, right?
Yeah, I mean, I think it'll probably slip a bit beyond that, but I don't think it's going to be like Woody, where the threes and the release were, a year or something apart. Mm-hmm. There's just so much pressure to get it out; it's palpable. But you know, I think what the Debian project needs to do is just sit down and decide we're gonna do a release every 18 months, and I used to think that was. Probably not something Debian could do, but you know, we've watched the GNOME project make a similar transformation very successfully, and that's a very diffuse project as well. So my feeling is, if GNOME can do it, Debian can too, and I think they really need to, or they're going to continue to have problems like this.
So if you were ultimately in total control of Debian now, or you had the chance to do it all over again, you would do it differently then? Or what would you
do? Well, if I were in total control now, I would definitely institute a time-based release cycle. And that would be my first priority. In terms of doing anything differently, you know, it's kind of hard to say. because, you know, I view this as just the latest, the latest in a long set of growing pains that any project that grows from one person to, you know, 1,200 people goes through. And there have been several such instances over the past 10 years where people have said, you know, Debian has grown as far as it can grow. It's gotten completely unmanageable. It's going to die. I remember people saying that when the project hit 200 developers, right? I mean, there's no way we can have more than 200 developers. Well, clearly that was wrong because now there's 1,200 or something. And I think similarly, you know, there was a lot of thrashing around and gnashing of teeth and these sorts of things at that time, just as there is now. But ultimately, I think Debian's going to get past it. You know, to say that I would, you know, from day one, I would have instituted this sort of thing, probably not, because it hasn't really been an issue until, you know, the last couple of releases. It's just Debian's getting bigger. It's getting hard to manage the release. It's really no more complicated than that.
Now, again, so I'm clear on something here. I want to make sure I'm clear on something here. When you're talking about the potential for forking incompatible packages, and that one of the complaints is that Debian is a little stale with regards, you know, and then people move to Ubuntu or Xandros, that kind of goes towards a newer applications, newer libraries, newer packages. Now, what you're saying here is about the concern is not so much as there being Ubuntu packages that will not run on Debian, but that the standard core stable Debian packages should be able to run on Ubuntu, and that Ubuntu can have their own separate package repository, and that's okay? Or is it...
So I put forth a proposal on my blog a couple weeks ago, and I think this problem could be solved very simply. The main problem is that a package built on Ubuntu should work on standard Debian unless it uses a feature that's only in Ubuntu, right? So if the standard Ubuntu system has, Beagle or something built into it, and they want to build an evolution package that hooks into that. Fine by me. I mean, I have no problem with that. It's advancing the state of the art. It's doing something that can't be done today, whatever. The problem I have is that there's kind of gratuitous linking against an updated core when there's no real advantage to doing that. So my proposal is, it's very simple, have some kind of a compatibility environment for Ubuntu, which is the default development environment, so that, you know, if you're a Debian developer running Ubuntu and you build a package on Ubuntu, by default it links against the Debian environment. So that way you can take your package, you can run it on Debian or you can run it on Ubuntu. That's not putting any undue restrictions on Ubuntu. But it is the absolutely critical thing that we have to maintain is the current truism that a Debian package is a Debian package is a Debian package, right? So that's my only real motivation here. As long as we can preserve that, whether it's, instituting some kind of compatibility layer to make sure that this problem goes away, or having Ubuntu completely, call their package format something other than deb.deb. I mean, that's really my only concern here, because, again, I've seen where this leads, and I don't really want to lose this particular technological advantage that we have over the RPM guys.
It's a purity control issue.
No, come on. I'm no purist. I'm the guy that I'm the guy that's been saying since 1997 that Debian should use RPM.
No, but it is so, it is a purity issue. You want the Debian packages to run on Debian, right? Like, you don't want
well, actually, I would call it
a...
I would I would call it more like truth in advertising.
Okay.
I mean, if something purports to be a Debian package, then it should probably run on Debian, don't
right.
you think?
Right.
Valid.
Right.
Now, let's take an example. You brought up Beagle. Now, if somebody takes the latest GNOME and builds it with Dbus support, how would you be able to backport that to stable Debian without making significant changes to the core?
Well, you may not be able to, and that's fine. So there may be some packages which are incompatible with Debian, but as long as they're clearly marked as being Ubuntu only, some guy isn't going to try to, say, hey, I got a Debian package for Network Manager. I'm going to try to install it on Debian and be surprised that it doesn't work. I'm not saying Ubuntu can't do what they need to do to add value or add new features or whatever it is they want to do. But I strongly suspect that the vast minority of packages built against Ubuntu link against stuff that's only in Ubuntu and not in Debian. And also just to add to that, I think that in all cases, maybe the Debian packages should work that way too. I mean, if there's a good reason the Ubuntu guys are doing things a certain way, then maybe Debian should do it that way too. So there should be some effort.
Isn't this really though just a does it boil down to a job for whoever is maintaining the app repositories to kind of look at this stuff? I mean, is that the easiest way to take care of it?
Well, I think there certainly needs to be more cooperation between, the Debian maintainers and the Ubuntu maintainers and the Progeny maintainers and everyone else. I mean, that's the approach we've always tried to take, in that, if we do something to a Debian package, we send the patch to Debian. And, we do that because we're nice guys. We also do it because, we'd rather have the patch folded into the upstream so we don't have to deal with it anymore. We want to be compatible with this huge, huge thing, which is called Debian. I think if people stop and think, step back, it's pretty obvious that everybody wins.
Right. Okay, so you get to a point where in a case where you might say, all right, we got to clearly identify that this is a Debian package and this is specifically a Ubuntu package. How do you do that? I mean, are you saying that, okay, that's not going to be a .deb package anymore, that we have to change the extension? I mean, how would you clearly identify that that is Ubuntu only?
Well, I think in an ideal case, as I said, these kinds of situations are the very, very rare exception, right? So if Ubuntu wants to provide a GNOME that has Dbus support, and they want to link a whole bunch of packages against it, and, they should probably be talking to the guys who maintain GNOME and Debian, too, right? This is what we're going to do. Maybe Dbus isn't far enough along in development, so maybe the Debian guys don't want to include it. But is there anything that the Debian guys can do to facilitate greater compatibility? Could they have a stub library for Dbus that, kind of provide a dummy package or something that satisfies the dependency so that you can still take that that Ubuntu package and install it, and it works fine, albeit without the Dbus functionality. So I guess don't overestimate how many exceptions there have to be. Because I think if people are working together, there doesn't have to be many at all. And in cases where there does, just clearly mark them. Call them .ubuntu, call them something else, call them .deb, just make sure that, in the post-inst or something, it says this thing doesn't work on Debian. I mean, it doesn't really matter how you do it, as long as you do it somehow.
Because my concern was, if you still call it .deb, and maybe it's going to eventually generate a situation like if you go to rpmfind.net and you're looking for a specific RPM, and you get like RPMs for all sorts of different distributions, and even though they all end in .rpm, there's a question, well, will it work on Red Hat or will it only work on Mandrake?
Yeah, and try installing that Mandrake package on Red Hat and see what happens. I mean, it's not a pretty picture.
Right. No, it's not. But it's always, you know, there's other less well-known. It's been a while since I've been to RPM Find, but, you know, there's some Polish distributions that were putting out RPMs, and occasionally, you know, they might work on Red Hat or another RPM-based distribution. You don't know. But they're just, you know, you might only be able to find the package you're looking for on some obscure RPM-based distribution.
Yeah, and you, okay, I'm thinking off the top of my head here, which is always dangerous, or talking off the top of my head. You know, you could solve this problem very easily by adding a flag to the Debian control file, which basically says this, you know, this package is compatible with Debian or Ubuntu or whatever else, and you know, it'd be a fairly simple matter to extend the package system to recognize that, right? In fact, the guy who maintains dpkg works for Canonical, which does Ubuntu. So, you know, we're in a pretty good position to do something about it if we want to do something about it.
Have you had any contact with the people at Canonical at all, or no?
Oh yeah, I mean they're all just Debian developers, and so we're all, you know, contact all the time, you know, myself and other people who work for me, and I talked to Mark a couple of times, you know, there hasn't been as much collaboration as I would have hoped there would be, but you know, hopefully that'll change.
AppGet is a great system. I love it. I think it should be the default Linux distribution method for doing packages. Did you think of that, or somebody else on the project come up with it?
No, I'm sorry to say I didn't come up with that. I wrote the original dpkg, but app came after my time, actually. But it is a fantastic tool, and you know, I think it's the single biggest reason that, you know, people try Debian and they don't usually go to anything else. It's the single biggest reason also why in those periods when I've used Red Hat or something else, I've gotten frustrated with it really quickly.
All right, Ian, sorry, one of them.
That's all right.
Ian, right?
I've been called worse. Ian, yes.
Ian. I have friends that are called Ian, so it's a hard transition for me. Ian,
I'll forgive you just this one time.
The obligatory questions now. We want to know what you have on your desktop, what it looks like, what you do with it, and don't lie to us because we can find out. We know these things.
Okay. So what I have on my desktop in terms of what?
Your operating
software?
System. Yeah, sure, software.
Well, I'm running Linux, of course. I'm running Progeny Debian Developer Edition. GNOME 2.8, lots of little nifty technologies like Beagle and F-Spot and Tomboy, and you know, it's pretty much a hacker's playground.
So now, are you Emacs or VI?
Emacs.
All right.
All the way. Although, you know, people often laugh when they notice that I sometimes use VI. It's, you know, it's old habits die hard. 10 years ago, Emacs took such a long time to start that if I was doing a quick little edit to a configuration file or something, I'd always use VI.
20 minutes ago, Emacs will take a long time to start.
you obviously weren't using Emacs 10 years ago. I mean, we're talking.
No, it's still starting, man.
You know, 2 seconds versus 45 or something. I mean, it's nowhere near as bad as it used to be.
What do you think of...
I'm an Emacs guy all the way.
What do you think of the XGL stuff that's they're playing around with?
I'm sorry, the what?
XGL. Have you followed up on any of that? The XGL portion?
XGL. It rings a bell, but I'm not...
True transparency, wobbly windows, integrating...
Oh, right, yeah.
OpenGL support into X.
Oh, I think that, you know, clearly it's the next step. I mean, and I'm really thrilled with what's happened with happening around X development these days. Actually, I had the pleasure of meeting Jim Geddes last summer, and he's behind a lot of that. Free desktop guys are behind a lot of it too. Pretty clearly, Windows is going that way. Mac OS X is going that way. The hardware is there. There's all kinds of neat things that you can do with these kinds of technologies. Just look at some of the stuff Sun is doing with Looking Glass. So, yeah, it's going to be really exciting over the next couple of years. I mean, I think desktop Linux is really, turned the corner we're going to start seeing more leading and less following in the years to come. There's no question about that.
So now using this came across on the IRC. They want to know: are you using just the default GNOME theme, or do you use a tweaked out theme?
I help maintain a distribution, so I can choose the default theme. But I have to say, it's one of those things. I can embed my own defaults into the operating system.
Is that the Ian theme? Impose
them on others. I just use the standard Progeny Debian theme, which is Zimian Industrial. Pretty boring, I know, but I try to use pretty much things as close to out of the box as possible because I want to know, what it's like for my users. If I'm using a really tweaked out thing, it's kind of hard to know what the default configuration looks and feels like.
All right. So you're using Evolution, right? Not Thunderbird?
Yeah.
And you use Firefox for your main browser?
Yep.
Yeah. Do you do any video production on your Linux boxes?
Not really, no. I've got three kids, so I got three kids and a video camera that I never use, so I probably should. It'd be a good justification for some extended hacking sessions with my wife. I'm just working on videos of the kids, honest.
That's a whole joy, the video editing in Linux. Oh.
Got to do a DVD.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the killer app for that?
It's called Headache.
It's one headache. Area. It's one yeah, area where Linux needs to address, I think.
You know, I don't really know because Kino is one of the easiest ones to start right off the bat with. You can pull in the video, you can export the video, but you can't do a lot of fancy editing or transitions or post-production effects with Kino. I guess they say the big one, the killer app, is Cinelera, but that is a monster in and of itself.
That's a beefy one right there.
I mean, that you need to take some time to sit down and actually learn how to use it. I've tried it. I can't even get my video in there.
They have Video GIMP, too, but that's still not very far along yet, I don't think.
Right. So, you're not finding something like iMovie on Linux.
That would be sweet. I think a lot of people would jump over if they had something comparable.
Now, you run it all i386, i686, Intel architecture, or do you use other architectures like PPC? Or AMD 64.
Personally, I'm all x86, but here at Progeny, we've got the AMD 64 and i64 and a bunch of other stuff. So we support those. But personally, I'm kind of I'm perfectly happy with x86. So I'll probably just stay on that until I'm not.
And you've been doing this a long time. So do you have any qualms about saying that Linux is ready for the desktop?
I'm sorry, say again?
Do you have any qualms about saying that Linux is ready for the desktop?
Oh, not at all. No. I probably did two or three years ago. So actually, Deborah is my, Deborah is the acid test for me. I actually tried to get her to use Linux 10 years ago, right? We were both in college, and I got her all set up in this what I viewed as this incredibly elegant environment, right? Where she would edit her papers in Emacs using LaTeX, and run them through LaTeX, and fire up Go script to print everything else. But she had a different view. And she's finally actually getting to the point now where she looks over my shoulder as I'm doing stuff in FSpot, which, if you haven't played with that, I've never seen a photo management application as good as that. And she's getting to the point now where she looks at it, she says, "I want to run that." And I say, "If you want to run that, you got to run Linux." And I show her Evolution and Firefox, and these things are ready for normal people. And so no qualms at all.
Now, was that F as in Frank Spot?
F, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Never heard of it.
It's one of those new Mono applications. It's written in C#. I think some guy at Novell is doing it. But
it's got
some great features. I don't know if Nat Friedman, I saw a video a couple weeks ago from BrainShare or something where Nat Friedman did a demo of it. It showed off there was a Beagle demo too, which just showed off some of this really neat new stuff that that those guys are doing.
Well, apparently it's on Ubuntu Hori, FSpot is. Well, there's a package available for it, so maybe there's a package available for Debian.
Yeah, it's in Debian Unstable. I don't know that it's in Sarge, but I think that you can just pull. If you're running Sarge, I think what I did is I just pulled the one from Unstable, and it worked fine.
All right.
Outstanding.
Anything else you'd like to add before we're getting close to the end here? Because
No, not really. I feel like I've been rambling. That's what I tend to do. So I hope I haven't been boring you.
Not at all. Everybody rambles on this show.
Okay. Well, that's why I'm fitting right in then.
What it's about. It's just like a big, Linux user group chat session afterwards.
I mean, I really enjoyed talking with you and reading your blog and everything, and I'm so damn tempted to install Debian on my main workstation and give it a whirl on that extra space I have on there.
Yeah, a few other people have done that, and they've been pleased. So.
All right.
Well, thank you very, very much, Ian.
Anytime,
it's
guys.
It's been a pleasure.
Taking the time to talk with us over here on the show, and I hope you give serious consideration to maybe letting us talk to you again sometime.
Sure, yeah. Just, give me a week or two notice, and I'd be happy to do it.
That'd be great.
And it's been fun.
Great.
All right, thanks a lot. Good luck.
Okay.
Take care.
All right, thanks.
Bye.
Bye.
Well, that was Ian Murdoch.
There you have it. Ian Murdoch, founder of Debian, progeny, and
he's got valid concerns about
all manner of other things.
Everything
too.
Forking and compatibility. These are major issues that need to be addressed.
I like a spork myself.
Yeah, me too.
You used to get sporks at Kentucky Fried Chicken, but I don't think they give them anymore.
You can't get a spork at Kentucky Fried Chicken.
No, I think they do the separate knife and fork.
Where is the uniqueness going in this world?
You get them a Taco Bell.
Everybody's got a copy.
A what? Taco
else,
Bell?
Taco Bell gives it to them.
Oh, if you get a taco salad or what are those rice bowls or whatever.
All right, everybody
are.
On IRC, we're meeting at the local Taco
Bell. Taco
Bell. right after the show. See you there.
Yeah, which one? There's three of them.
Yeah, well, it depends on where they're joining us from chat, too. You know, their local Taco Bell might not be so local to us.
Taco Hell. Again,
they might even have an old KFC that still gives sporks out, too.
You know, there's a KFC AW root beer down the road here that has AW on tap.
Yeah.
Ooh. It's really good. I mean, they don't give you a spork, but they also...
How do we go from, like, Debian and Ian Murdoch to sporks, man?
Sporking and forking.
We just wander. Wander around the conversation.
.spork.
You know, we probably... If Pat would have brought us some beer again tonight, we probably could have, like, stayed on to a topic line.
You know what we need, man? We need to hit the Weibacher Brewery Tour.
There we go.
I sent an email to those guys about maybe organizing some kind of a special... demonstration and tour for us and some of our listeners and some of the guys from the Lug, and I think people would go. They usually do them on Saturdays,
yeah,
so as soon as I get some information, I'll pass that along, and maybe we can get something together, and it'll be a good day.
Tech Show Beer Tour.
We'll get hammered.
I'm going to try F-Spot out, and then maybe later I'll try the G-Spot out. We still got 10 minutes. I don't think we have a choice. I checked
at a couple different distributions.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We have...
Linspire and Mepis. Linspire is very newbie-centric. There's some good things about it. They have a bunch of tutorials that they go through, video tutorials with audio, you know, for people who are new to Linux in general.
What are the tutorials with video format?
I think it's Flash. I mean,
oh, it's Flash based.
It comes, you know, they have a very wide array of all the different codecs pre-installed. They have a decent set of applications installed, and you know, click and run. It's pretty straightforward. It's very synaptic like, and you go in there, you just pick a package, and off it goes. My problem.
Question for you.
Sure.
Now, with Linspire, you do pay for the click and run service, but one of the reasons why you. If I'm not mistaken, the distribution you have to actually purchase is because of the licensing of the codecs.
The codecs. What it is they'll give you the base system for $50, and they'll give you, I think, 2 weeks free of click and run. Okay? They don't give you a GCC compiler, though. So if you're going to compile your own, install the GCC compiler, you know, right away. I believe they charge an extra $25
for the GCC compiler.
No,
for
click and run after the base install.
Okay,
and I think it's $45 to keep it yearly subscription. What else?
But now, can you update that through like AppGit or whatever?
Yes.
Without the click and run,
it's a little hairy from what I've read. You got to be very careful and know what the hell you're doing. You could break it very easily, supposedly. So. I mean, for me or you or someone who wants to learn about Linux and more deeper, you know, it's great. You know, I listened to the Lug Radio guys. They talked to Mark Harmony, and he basically said, you know, they want to be the AOL of Linux, which is fine. You know, they're going for a niche, and that's what they want to be.
More power to them.
Exactly.
At least it proves that the model works, you know?
Exactly. And on the flip side, I checked out Mepis. You know, we talked to Warren Woodford from Mepis, and I installed 3.3. And I was totally blown away with what it was, man. I like it better than Ubuntu, to be honest. It's KDE. You know, me personally, I prefer KDE over GNOME. It has the most complete set of applications that I've seen on any install disk, period, bar none. It has every codec pre-installed. It has Java pre-installed. Some of the applications that it came with was Skype.
Every video codec?
You say every, what do you mean exactly?
I mean, does it Windows Media support? I'm going to say, how could he put that out on a disk unless
I don't know Windows Media. I know Linspire has Windows Media. I don't think Mepis does.
Yeah, but you're paying for that.
Yeah. Well, one of the things about Linspire was that the DVD player that they developed, you have to pay an extra $10 for it, but it's licensed. If you install, you know, Zine or Ogle from Click and Run, it won't play any encrypted DVDs, just an FYI. But
AppGit.
Yeah, you can do it yourself and install the codecs yourself, you know, or compile it. But Mepis is very slick. You know, recently, last week or so, they've announced that they're going to actually have machines pre-installed with Mepis and
laptops,
desktops.
Yeah.
You know, me personally, I'm going to be looking for a new laptop probably in the next year or two. I might be inclined to buy one, to be honest. It's really slick, and I think the install CD, it boots up as a bootable, and you could try it. You'll see all the applications that are on there.
Fully functional. Bootable live CD?
Fully functional.
Yeah.
There's a little icon to click it to install. The install is, you know, cakewalk. It's real simple.
Yeah, I'll be putting that on my spare workstation tomorrow.
You got to try it, man. It's really good. I really liked it a lot. And it's even more incredible because it's one guy doing everything. But it looks like he's trying to, you know, hire some more people. He's talking about doing an AMD 64 distro as well as PPC. If he could do that, you know, I think he would be in really great shape. You know, download it, bootable, check it out, you know, and see maybe if you want to install it. I like it. Like I said, I got rid of Ubuntu when I put that on there in the machine that I had it on.
Goodbye.
Pat says it's good. You know, it must be good.
Another really great.
I'm sending my money to Michael Robertson.
Is Damn Small Linux. Excellent
Damn.
Bootable CD. Really good. Really lightweight. 50
Which
meg.
Which is 1. They just released a 1. Something, right?
1.1 is what I got.
Yeah, that's really nice.
It's excellent.
It's
they have a version of the ISO that you could put on a USB thumb drive.
Yep.
And you'll boot right off the thumb drive, or you could just burn it to a regular old CD, and it's great.
Yes,
I have this creaky old PC in my office, you know, 233 megahertz.
Mm-hmm.
Ran like a champ.
There's another one just like that called Feather Linux.
Feather, I've heard of that one, yeah.
Which is also very, very good.
Damn Small.
I think I like Damn Small a little bit better.
Damn Small uses the Nopix detection routines,
mm-hmm.
and I believe it's also built on Debian as well.
Mm-hmm.
And I think, what is it, Fluxbox, I think is the default one.
Right, Debian, but it's Fluxbox.
But it's really tweaked out, and it's really customized,
and
it looks really sweet, man.
DF Desk or something. I can't even remember what the name of this
is. And then there are some other applications that are on there.
Icon support on Fluxbox and all kinds of stuff.
It's really nice. I like it better than Nopix.
It's really nice, and it fits on like 50 meg or something like
meg.
That. So it's just an awesome thing. That I carry like two or three of those, along with the obligatory Nopix discs and Ubuntu Live CDs and stuff like that. But I carry those around. I used to carry one in my wallet because they're so small. You can get them on one of the credit card shaped CDs. Not the completely round ones, but the ones with, you know, the flat edges.
How does that work? Like that. You need some kind of an insert, right?
No.
No?
Tampon.
No.
It doesn't fly around inside the drive?
Every CD drive has a little round recess in the middle that those will fit right into. And you just stick them right in there and let it go. You know,
you mean the coffee cup holder?
Yeah, the coffee cup holder. The ones that, you know, my secretaries use for. Secretaries use for big gulp holders, you know, that kind of stuff.
Good stuff.
But definitely.
I tried, you know, this Sunday I was over at my parents' house, and I was showing my dad Mepis, and he seemed really interested in it on his Dell. You know, he's getting spyware, and it's slowing his machine down. So I'm going to try to convince him to install it, get rid of that Windows.
No, it's not as hard as it sounds, man. My dad started running Linux, and he's using, what was he? He was using Mepis, too. And he really likes it. I mean, he really digs it, you know.
The thing
installed
that
installed it all by itself. And
the thing I liked about Mepis as compared to Linspire was that Mepis gives you a more complete set of tools to use if you want to go deeper into it. Whereas Linspire, you know, you're pretty much peg-holed into the newbie area, you know. You know, it's kind of crazy. They don't give you the compiler, you know.
Well, you can take that up with Michael Robertson in 2 weeks.
We will.
We're gonna
grill his ass.
You know what? I have a quick question.
Listening,
there's another mention, so we got like a minute and a half. Sony patenting the brain beaming technology. They're patenting the idea, right? Not the technology.
Yes, it's the idea.
Because I think that is absolutely wrong. They should not be able to patent that idea because now that prevents any other company from actually trying to develop the technology to do that.
You know what, though?
That's not
I really am of the opinion that very soon that the United States, and this is, we live in the United States, by the way, if you didn't know, the United States is going to have to completely overhaul.
What is that?
It's an ant. It's going to have to completely overhaul the patent system because obviously it does not work. You know what I mean?
All right, wrap it up, B. We got 40 seconds.
Listen here, I'm going to play this generic intro thing again that Dan made because I think it's pretty cool, and we'll wrap the show up with that. I'm Link.
Dan.
And Pat.
This is episode 83 of the Linux Link Tech
Without
Show.
Without Alan.
Who? Join us next week for 84. Poof,
there we go.
Good night, everybody.
Good night.
What are you doing? Put those back up.